And the United States would be finding itself struggling to find a way to end this war and get the what it wanted. President Trump's playbook did not work out here. And in fact, in the end, the United States did get its pilot out, after a very harrowing several days of trying to find him, a shootout that ultimately got him out. But also the Iranians claimed that actually, under the cover of the operation to get the pilot out, the United States did try to carry out an operation to recover the highly enriched uranium in the city of Isfahan, and that failed. And that's the only reason why the United States agreed to go to Islamabad. So it's very clear that the president is struggling to find a strategy that would actually bring this war to conclusion in a way that he could get the objectives for which he actually started the war. So looking past all the rhetoric, the sort of blizzard of tweets he puts out, the threats, the talk of great conversations with Iranians, threatening him, etc., the fact remains that he started a war that he cannot easily end on terms that he can claim victory over.
Vali Nasr, I want to thank you for being with us, Iranian-American professor of International Affairs and Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS. He's the author of Iran's Grand Strategy of Political History. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to look at the U.S. and Israeli war in Iran, we're joined now by Mariam Jamshidi. She's an Iranian-American associate professor of law at the University of Colorado Law School and a non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. She's written a new piece for The Nation magazine headlined, "Only One Side Has Clearly Broken the Law in the Strait of Hormuz, and It Isn't Iran." Professor Jamshidi, explain.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me. So, you know, what I was trying to get at in that piece is that, you know, there's been a lot of international outcry about what Iran has done in the Strait, specifically its efforts to regulate passage of ships through the Strait and to charge certain ships a fee for going through the Strait. The international rhetoric has been that what Iran is doing is completely and clearly illegal. And from my perspective, that's not entirely true. This is not a black and white issue. Iran does have a reasonable legal argument to regulating the Strait of Hormuz, as well as to charging fees. By contrast, the criticism of what the United States and Israel has done to Iran, which is an aggressive and illegal war, has been more muted, in particular from Western states, as well as from some of the regional Arab states. And I think this contrast between these two reactions is very telling. On the one hand, total condemnation of Iran on legal issues that are far from clear, and very more muted criticism, more limited criticism of the United States and Israel when it comes to actions they've taken that are very clearly unlawful under international law. I think this says a lot about the ways in which international law is being deployed in this moment as a way of restraining and regulating Iranian behavior while effectively allowing the United States and Israel a free hand to do what they want against the Iranian government.
What do you think this unprovoked war that Israel and the U.S., this war of choice, as it's called, have engaged in with Iran, has done to international law and people's perspective view of it around the world and the consequences when people want to apply international law?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, you know, over the last few years, we've seen the ways in which Israel in particular, with, you know, support from the United States, as well as with support from much of the rest of the West, Western governments, has eroded and violated and, you know, scoffed at international law and its actions towards the Palestinians, its actions in Lebanon, its actions in Syria, its actions in Yemen, its other actions in Iran, you know, and I think that, you know, these actions that Israel has taken has understandably led many to question the utility and importance of international law, whether or not it still exists or not. And, you know, now with this war against Iran, that those concerns, those fears that international law is really meaningless have only increased. You know, in this moment, though, I think what's also important to understand is that states like Iran are also at the same time saying, no, international law matters very much, and we expect to be treated as equals under international law. Iran in this moment is framing a lot of what it's doing in international law terms because it understands that if international law is truly going to be thrown into the dustbin, then it's going to be far more vulnerable on the international stage. So we basically see a battle. We see a battle between, on the one side, states like Israel and the United States, states that are by and large Western, you know, basically saying international law doesn't apply to us. We can do what we want. And then other states like Iran, states of the global south, saying, no, we want international law. We value international law. International law is necessary to ensuring that we are sovereign and equal to other states on the international scale. And so we are not going to let international law just be taken away from us.
Can you talk more about the UN Security Council? You've noted multiple resolutions have been introduced to condemn Iran's regulatory actions in the Strait. Who is behind these resolutions? Meanwhile, the Iranian parliament's reportedly considering legislation that would formalize its regulatory system, including the fee system, as part of its domestic law.
Right. So there have been multiple resolutions brought before the Security Council since the war started. They have mostly been focused on Iran and Iran's actions in the Strait of Hormuz. The states that have been the real force behind these resolutions appear to be the Arab Gulf states, in particular Bahrain and the UAE, who have also been the subject of the most attacks by Iran. What's, again, very interesting and I think important to understand about these resolutions is that they very clearly and absolutely condemned Iran for its regulatory actions within the Strait of Hormuz. As I mentioned, even though those actions do have a legal basis, those resolutions presented them as being fully unlawful. And one of those resolutions, which thankfully was vetoed by China and Russia, would have effectively authorized all UN member states, that's over 190 states, to go to war with Iran in order to open the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, that is a very radical proposition to basically validate and allow states to engage in armed conflict against another state simply for the purpose of opening a waterway. So, you know, and again, there were no resolutions that were brought to the Security Council to explicitly condemn the U.S. and Israel for their actions against Iran. In terms of the domestic legislation inside Iran, you know, that the Iranian parliament appears to be contemplating, as you mentioned, this legislation would basically make the regulatory scheme within Hormuz, in the Strait of Hormuz, a part of Iranian law. It's not entirely clear what the terms of that law are, you know, what the basis for it is, what kind of regulation it'll in fact implement. But it does seem to have a fee system as a part of it. So the Iranians are trying to take this ad hoc fee system that they have developed over the course of the last few weeks and actually institutionalize it within domestic law.
I wanted to end by asking you about Trump's comments. On Saturday, he told a reporter at Fox News, quote, "If Iran doesn't sign this deal, the whole country is getting blown up." That followed 2 weeks before when he warned a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again. Professor Jamshidi.
I mean, you know, these comments are absolutely unacceptable. I mean, they are borderline genocidal in their intent and in their implications. To say to the world that you're going to obliterate an entire civilization is, in fact, to make very clear that you desire to destroy an entire people. You know, I don't know if he thinks that this is an effective negotiating tool, but certainly from a legal perspective, from a moral perspective, it's beyond the pale.
Mariam Jamshidi, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Iranian-American Associate Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Law School, non-resident fellow at the Quincy Institute. We'll link to your piece in The Nation. Only one side's clearly broken the law in the Strait of Hormuz, and it isn't Iran. Coming up, the acclaimed artist and activist Shepard Fairey. We met up with him at his Los Angeles gallery. Stay with us. صوتي ما عنده حدود صوتي مالوش نهاية صوتي يرسم لي وجود والوان جديدة في سمايا صوتي ما عنده حدود صوتي مالوش نهاية صوتي يرسم by Emel Mathluthi, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Last week, when I was in Los Angeles for the theatrical opening of the documentary Steal This Story, Please, about Democracy Now!, I visited the gallery of the artist Shepard Fairey. He created the artwork for Steal the Story, Please poster. Shepard Fairey gained national prominence in 2008 as the artist who made the iconic poster of then-candidate Barack Obama, accompanied by the word hope. He has roots as a street artist with well-known images wheat-pasted on walls around the world, including one of professional wrestler Andre the Giant and the word obey. I asked Shepard Fairey about his thoughts about art and politics and described some of the pieces hanging in his latest exhibition.
I think art can help turn things around by taking something that's a, you know, a feeling more in the ether and crystallizing it in a way that's you know, very direct, clear, and resonates with someone's emotion. You know, art can be used to persuade people in bad ways too. I've always looked at my art as not propaganda, in that it's meant to be the end of the conversation, but that it's, if you want to call it propaganda, it's meant to initiate a conversation, a counter-narrative that isn't happening in robust enough way.
Can you tell me about the Statue of Liberty in handcuffs?
Of course, the "it can't happen here" is a reference to Sinclair Lewis's novel of the same name that's examining the rise of fascism in the United States, and it's a cautionary thing based on some of what was happening in the 20s and 30s in the United States, but we are experiencing it in a more intense way here now. So it can happen here, and it is.
Shepard Fairey then walked me around his gallery, showing me some of his other work.
We then walked over to a quartet of posters. Each showed an ICE officer in riot gear holding a baton. Above each is a label: paid agitator, domestic terrorist, intent to massacre, and worst of the worst.
They have differences, but it's the same dominant figure in each one. But I mean, I did these because this is, it's called projection mirror. These are based on all the things that Christy Noem and Stephen Miller threw out there about the protesters and about the immigrants that were being targeted. That really is what they're up to. They're the paid agitators. They're the domestic terrorists. They're out there with intent to massacre, and they're the worst of the worst. So, the series was meant to be a mirror back at the people projecting.
We went to another image that showed an oil derrick. Can you say what it says?
Extracting blood at the world's end, igniting the globe. It's basically about how this extracting oil, that the fossil fuels are heating the planet up and killing the planet, and a lot of people are still saying drill, baby, drill, keep the price of gas down, and we need to be investing in renewables.
I'm intrigued by how much you use newspapers. Like, here we have Frida Kahlo.
Oh yeah, well, newspapers I think are great in, first of all, like, making sure that you can read what the idea is succinctly, or it creates a little bit of an amplification to what the primary narrative of the piece is. But it also demonstrates that we frequently have been warned about mistakes that we're making, or we're making the same mistakes again and again. I can pull newspaper things from 40 years ago about civil rights or global warming or any number of other issues. And we think we progress, but we always relapse to bad behavior. And I want to remind people that, hey, we should know better.
Tell me about this Frida Kahlo. You have a lot. This one with the newspaper that says her name.
So, I'm a big admirer of Frida Kahlo's work and her feminism relative to her era, especially, and the ways in which she talked about art as a tool of resilience, that art helped her to overcome the pain of her bus accident she had when she was young that gave her chronic pain through her life. But also, I love that Frida Kahlo was initially seen as like this cute romantic partner to the important Diego Rivera. Now she's more well known and more celebrated than Diego Rivera. They're both very important artists, but I think that the progress we've made in terms of her being someone who's taken very seriously as a woman artist is important progress, but we still have a long way to go.
That's the acclaimed artist and activist Shepard Fairey speaking at his Los Angeles gallery. He made the poster art for the film about Democracy Now! Called Steal This Story, Please. I'm here in the Bay Area as the film opens in different theaters. Tonight I'll be in Sebastopol at the Rialto Cinema Sebastopol for the 4 and 6 o'clock screenings of the film. And then tomorrow we'll be in Sacramento at the Tower Theater Sacramento at 7 o'clock. On Wednesday, we'll be at the Rialto in Elmwood in Berkeley, as well as the Roxy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll look at the Trump administration's plan to restructure the U.S. Forest Service, which many fear will dismantle the 120-year-old agency. Back in a minute. Jedar mangat kukre, jedar mangat kukre. Jedar mangat kukre, jedar mangat kukre.
Jano jo na pucho jati. Jano jo na pucho jati. Aage jata na hai.
Jot, Sunny Singh performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to major changes underway at the U.S. Forest Service, the federal agency responsible for managing 193 million acres of public lands, forests and grasslands located across 43 states, the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. In late March, the Trump administration announced an extensive reorganization of the agency that'll shutter 57 of 77 research stations across the U.S. while relocating the agency's headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Salt Lake City, Utah. In a press release, the Forest Service chief, Tom Schultz, said, quote, "This is about building a Forest Service that's nimble, efficient, effective, and closer to the forests and communities it serves," he said. Our next guest describes the changes very differently. In an article headlined, "Trump Administration Orders Dismantling of the U.S. Forest Service," Jim Pattes writes, quote, "With the subtlety of a wrecking ball and the morality of a foreclosure notice, the Trump administration announced the most devastating attack on the U.S. Forest Service in the agency's 121-year history. Not a budget cut, not a policy shift, not a reorganization, an execution. The largest public land agency in the country just handed on a silver platter to the people who've spent their entire careers trying to destroy it." Jim Pattes is a conservationist and filmmaker. He runs the organization and newsletter More Than Just Parks. Together with his brother, Will Pattes, they track threats to public lands across the country. Joining us now from Atlanta, Georgia. Jim Pattes, thanks so much for being here. Explain what's at stake.
Yeah, well, Amy, you know, you said it at the top here. The Forest Service manages over 193 million acres of our public land. That's larger than the state of Texas. It's more than twice the amount of land that the National Park Service manages. You know, this is a critically important agency. And, you know, it's kind of the backbone of our public lands. What the Trump administration has announced that they're doing, you know, when you move the headquarters from Washington, D.C. to Salt Lake City, Utah, we need to keep in mind Salt Lake City, Utah, this is the state that is currently suing the federal government to take control of 18.5 million acres of your public land. It's an unprecedented lawsuit. And when you move the headquarters there, you're sending a signal that you agree with what this state is doing. Utah has already signed unprecedented agreements with the Forest Service to give them management control of their lands, of the Forest Service lands within the state. And then, you know, shuttering 57 of 77 research facilities. The Forest Service Research Program is the foremost forest research program in the world. It provides critical information for how we manage our forests as well as fight wildfires. And then the regional offices, that's another big one. They're shuttering all nine Forest Service regional offices. This is really where the institutional knowledge of the Forest Service is housed. And when you get rid of those offices, you know, the goal here is to make the agency subservient to the resource extraction industry that the Trump administration is aligned with.
Can you talk about who you think the Forest Service is being given over to? I mean, first of all, obviously, sending from Washington, D.C., the Forest Service to Salt Lake City, you're going to lose a massive amount of experience for people who cannot move. But then talk about who it's in the hands of, who's in charge now.
Yeah, I think something people need to understand is the Trump administration has done this before on a much smaller scale. In Trump's first term, they moved the Bureau of Land Management, another very large public land management agency, from Washington, D.C., the headquarters from D.C. to Grand Junction, Colorado. That resulted in 87% of the affected staff walking out the door. Only three people showed up to the new office at Grand Junction. And, you know, you can talk to people who work at the Bureau of Land Management now and did under the Biden administration. President Biden moved it back to D.C., but the agency has never recovered. I mean, you're talking about so much institutional knowledge and key people leaving out the door because they simply can't uproot their lives and their families to move to this far-flung, you know, new headquarters. Same thing's playing out here with the Forest Service, but on a much larger scale. This decision will impact up to 5,000 employees, and this is an agency that has already lost over a fourth of its entire staff since Trump took office last January. And then you asked me about, you know, who this hands it to. I mean, I think, you know, look no further than the state of Utah and the anti-public lands movement. You can look throughout the Trump administration up and down in positions of leadership in land management agencies. These are people who are avowed proponents of transferring our federal public lands to states and private interests. The sitting chief of the United States Forest Service, his previous job was as the executive of a logging company. That's unprecedented in the history of the Forest Service to have the chief as a logging executive. And so, you know, the current nominee for the Bureau of Land Management is former Congressman Steve Pierce from New Mexico. And this is a man who said Theodore Roosevelt was wrong to create national parks and national forests. So the intent here is obvious. It's to hollow out this agency and hand it to the resource extraction industry and prepare it for potentially the eventual transfer of our public lands to states.
You've called it asset stripping, and you say it's illegal. Explain, Jim.
Well, you know, asset stripping is a term that is used in private equity, and it's basically where you have people come in. You know, this happened famously with Sears, right, where you come in and you strip out all the parts that are worth any value and you sell them off, and then you leave a hollowed out shell of the company. And that's what the Trump administration is doing with our public lands. The Secretary of the Interior famously calls them America's balance sheet. And what they've been doing is raiding them and giving them to their allies in the resource extraction industry. So that's been the goal here with what the Trump administration is doing. And yeah, when you do that, you know, you leave a broken agency. And I think, you know, what they want to do is break the Forest Service, you know, drain it of its ability to manage our lands properly, and then leave it point at this broken agency and say, you know, look, this thing doesn't work very well anyway. We already now have these new state directors, which they've created, which will be basically political appointees and liaisons for the Forest Service to work with states in managing the forests. And they'll be able to say, look, we've already kind of got this set up for the states to take over. Why don't we just, go ahead and do it?
10 seconds, you say it's illegal.
Yes, it's illegal because in the appropriations bills that Congress passed, they explicitly forbade the reprogramming of funds for the Forest Service and the reorganization of its offices. It explicitly says you can't move Forest Service offices, you can't move the headquarters, and they're proceeding with that anyway.
Jim Pattiz, I thank you so much for being with us. Filmmaker and conservationist, along with his brother Will, runs an organization, Substack newsletter, More Than Just Parks. That does it for our show. Again, tonight, I'll be in Sebastopol at 3:40 and 7 for the screenings of Steal the Story, Please, the documentary about Democracy Now!, tomorrow in Sacramento at the Tower Theater, and then in Berkeley at the Rialto. I'm Amy Goodman. Check our website at democracynow.org from San Francisco.
Are you a fan of industrial and have been trying to find smaller artists? Have you only heard of Nine Inch Nails and are looking to get further into the genre? Maybe you're like that guy I met in my lecture who hadn't even heard of Linkin Park. No matter where you're coming from, Wire & Nerve is the show for you. 1 hour of all kinds of industrial, from Throbbing Gristle to Godflesh to Frontline Assembly and more. Tune in Mondays 7 to 8 p.m. only on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby.
Hi, it's Nardwar, the human serviette saying, you're listening to CJSF Burnaby and doo doo loo doo CJSF.